Judge Graber and I are very pleased to be joined again by Judge O'Malley from the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, and who made a special trip out here for this case, and we really appreciate you taking the time to fly in to hear this important matter.
Thank you.
Nice to all see all of you again, so you may proceed.
May it please the Court, Arthur Catterall of the Justice Department on behalf of the Commissioner, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if that's okay. This case is about whether Treasury permissibly concluded that the 2003 cost-sharing amendments to the Section 482 regulations are consistent with the arm's-length standard and whether it adequately explained the basis for its conclusion during the rulemaking process. Now, because the arm's length standard is actually articulated in and made applicable in every case by the Section 482 regulations rather than Section 482 itself, we view the permissibility inquiry as comprising two issues, which we set forth in our supplemental brief. The first issue is whether Treasury's understanding of the arm's length standard, as that understanding is reflected in the 2003 cost-sharing amendments, comports with the language of the regulation articulating that standard, which is Section 1.482-1B1. And the second issue is whether Treasury's understanding of the arm's length standard comports with the authority granted to Treasury under Section 482 to allocate income and deductions among commonly controlled entities in order to prevent evasion of taxes, or clearly to reflect the income of such entities.
Okay, let me just try to make sure that I'm clear on how you think we structure this analysis. Putting aside the State Farm issue and where it would show up in the inquiry, isn't the first question whether or not the statute itself is ambiguous? In other words, permitting regulation in the space.
That's you're referring to step one of Chevron.
Right.
Yes.
All right. And you agree, I mean, I went back and listened to the argument from the last time, you agree, the government agrees that the statute is ambiguous. Is that right?
Right.
In fact, I think
it does not address the precise question at
issue. Okay. I think your words were, there's no doubt that it's ambiguous, is the way you phrased it the last time.
Okay.
All right. And that's because there's nothing that explicitly says that the commensurate with income standard could be applied in these circumstances. Is that right?
Correct. There's nothing in the statute that addresses cost-sharing arrangements in general. And also, as you know, the words arm's length do not appear in the statute. So we think it's ambiguous on
several. Well, it doesn't. But you concede that it's implicit in
yes,
the statute.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I have a slightly different question, if I may. Looking directly at the statute, the first question seems to me to be whether the arrangement here is a transfer within the meaning of Section 482, which is not about the other regulations, but is just about the statute. And if the cost-sharing arrangements are transfers, do they also have to be arm's length, or is that a separate permission?
No, they have to be arm's length.
Why?
Because the arm's length standard applies in every case. That's the regulation expressly says that.
But you take a different view of what arm's length means.
This whole case is about what does the arm's length standard mean, and who gets to say what it means.
I understand how, with respect to transfers, you made the argument, or that Congress passed a statute that says, as it relates to transfers and licenses, it's possible that the comparables are not perfect. I mean, wasn't that what at least the initial purpose of the amendment was?
I think the purpose of the amendment was it basically creates a presumption that that transactions involving intangible property between unrelated parties, the evidence is
well, but the language of the statute doesn't say transactions, right? It says transfers and licenses.
Correct.
And there are comparables when it comes to transfers and licenses, correct?
I would say that's the whole point behind the commensurate with income requirement, is that Congress did not think that the evidence of comparable transactions was reliable enough.
Right, but I guess I'm trying to get to the point is that there is a distinction between an imperfect comparable and the total absence of a comparable, correct?
Sure, sure.
And so with respect to transfers and licenses, there are always comparables. They're just what Congress felt is that they were imperfect.
Sure, sure. I would agree with that.
Okay. Now, you've taken the position that even when, I mean, is your position that there are no comparables with respect to cost-sharing arrangements, or that even if the comparable is, that it wouldn't be taken into account, that fact can be ignored?
Well, what we're saying is that basically the commensurate with income requirement establishes a presumption that unless the transaction, if you're trying to, infer a result from the unrelated transaction to the related transaction, if the result you get does not satisfy the commensurate with income requirement, then the alleged comparable is simply deemed not to be comparable.
Well, what's your response to your friend's argument on the other side that if you take that to its logical extreme, you do away with comparability analysis completely? Because you can always just say, well, let's just use commensurate with income. If we don't get an exact parity, or we don't get to where we think the best tax value is.
Well, I don't think you do away with comparability altogether. It's just that, again, if you are relying on a comparable transaction in the transfer or license context, if the result you get by looking at that transaction does not satisfy the commensurate with income requirement, then it's simply not a comparable transaction.
I mean, so you view it as essentially a definition of what is an arm's length value in the case in which there is a transfer or license of intangible property. It's sort of a subset in your view.
Right. I mean, again, the statute is clear that the income attributable to the intangible must be commensurate with the royalty payment. So again, if you don't satisfy that requirement, then it's simply not a comparable.
Is there an economic basis for your argument that you can simply define this to be arm's length, or are you just saying that Treasury has the right to artificially define it to be arm's length?
Well, I don't think it's artificial. I think, again, when you look at the legislative history of the 1986 Act, and Congress said that the purpose of the commensurate with income requirement was to ensure that the terms of the transaction reflect the relative economic activity of each party. And so that's the economic principle. That's the animating economic principle. And in practice, one consequence of the commensurate with income requirement is this notion that in the transfer or in the license context, the idea that you need to go back and make periodic adjustments to take into account actual profit experience. And the thing is, everybody agrees, because and that's in the House report where Congress said we expect this periodic adjustments to be taken. And the thing is, You know, we have cited sources indicating that this periodic adjustment rule does not reflect what parties do in the real world. If the commensurate with income requirement has any meaning at all, under Altera's position, the arm's length standard says you have to look at evidence of third party behavior in all instances. Well, if that were true, then evidence of third party behavior could override this periodic adjustment rule. And nobody says nobody's arguing that. So it's the same type of analysis when you get to cost sharing arrangements.
Okay, back to the way you wanted to structure the argument. You said the other question is whether Treasury's interpretation of the regulations is reasonable. Is that right?
And the reason I say that is because, a big part of Altera's argument is that the term, arm's length standard, means X. It means you have to take into account evidence of third-party behavior in all circumstances. And, the actual language of the arm's length standard is in the regulation. So it seems to me that, the first inquiry is whether Treasury is reading its own regulation correctly.
So we're dropping all the way to our deference. Is that right?
Well, we didn't. We didn't ask for our deference. I don't think you need our deference.
Well, if we're considering whether Treasury is reading its own regulations in a reasonable fashion, isn't that exactly what our is all about?
Well, sure. And I think, if I guess our, kind of like Chevron, asks, is this a permissible reading? And we certainly think it's permissible, but I wouldn't limit it to a permissible reading. We think it's the best reading of the regulation.
The best reading analysis applies to the statute, right? Assuming that we have to interpret it in the first instance, if we find that there's something inappropriate about the regulation or how it was passed, then we decide what the best reading of the statute is in the first instance, right? But when you're talking about interpretation of the regulation, ours says, is it a reasonable interpretation?
Sure. I do not disagree with you. So
in Xilinx, this court said that the regulation, the regulatory scheme as a whole, was itself ambiguous, right?
Right.
And I know that you pointed out to the footnote that they said maybe the amendments could fix that ambiguity. So is that your view that by putting these amendments in, these coordinating amendments, that you've taken away any ambiguity in the regulatory scheme, since all the pieces and parts have to be considered together?
Yes. I mean, these amendments make explicit what Treasury was arguing was implicit in the prior regulations.
And they make explicit simply by the ipsy dixit of saying that this is the arm's length standard.
Well, yeah, they ground that conclusion on what was in the 1986 conference report, which said, we are aware of these cost-sharing arrangements. We don't intend to preclude the continued use of cost-sharing arrangements to the extent that they reflect the principles of this new statutory commensurate with income requirement. And then the report went a step further and said, here's what we mean by that. You have to share all costs in proportion to anticipated benefits. And that's exactly what the regulation says. So, if I may. Getting back to the APA question, what is amazing to me is that in the 417 pages of comments to the proposed regulations that Alterra has provided to the court, the 1986 conference report shows up exactly twice, and both times it's in a background discussion with no suggestion that Treasury misread it. And one commenter stated in one breath that the proposed regs are not consistent with the arm's length standard, and then it states, we have chosen not to address in these comments the question of whether the proposed regulations are consistent with the congressional mandate under Section 482. But if the regulations are consistent with the congressional mandate under Section 482, and the mandate incorporates the arm's length standard, then how could the regulations violate that standard, or more to the point, Congress's understanding of that standard? And I see I'm into my rebuttal time.
Very well. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Donald Falk for Alterra. Every time the government explains this rule, it seems to have a little bit different story. And there's a reason for that, because no matter what angle they come at it with, it just doesn't hold up.
Well, counsel, clearly the statute requires that if there's a transfer or license of intangible property, the income with respect to it must, under the wording of the statute, be commensurate with the income attributable to the intangible. So if this is a transfer or license of intangible property, the statute requires the commensurate with income principle. Why isn't this a transfer?
Well, I'll answer that question first, and then I have another point, I think, to make that I don't think it, even whether or not it's a transfer, I don't think that answers the question here. It's not a transfer because the cost-sharing agreement allocates in advance the rights to the intellectual property as it's developed, and economically it's quite different from a royalty or a license. And
it's about future royalties or licenses, for sure, because, I mean, it's... Otherwise, there'd be nothing to share.
But it is something that affects the economic rights as they come into being, and indeed the Treasury recognizes
it
that
affects them by transferring them or licensing them.
Well, that may ultimately be the case in particular arrangements, but the Treasury regulations recognize in 7AH1 that these are reimbursement payments, not royalty payments, which is significant given the withholding consequences and reflects Treasury's recognition, also expressed in the white paper, that cost sharing avoids the issues with transfers of intellectual property. And the legislative history, I think, supports the view that the Act does not directly apply except in royalty payment situations.
Except that if there is a transfer that is other than a license, it may not be in the form of a royalty. It could be an outright payment.
It could be an outright payment,
or some other form of income.
That is true. But what the legislative history says at page 638 of the conference report is, cost sharing arrangements to produce results consistent with the changes made by the Act to royalty arrangements, and it says they should be proportionate to profit. But it doesn't directly apply. It doesn't directly apply the standard. And in fact, I think the key point here is nothing about commensurate with income wipes away the arm's length standard from every stage of the analysis.
But vice versa is true also, because if an arm's length analysis yields something that is not commensurate with income for a transfer or license of intangible property, then it wipes out the second sentence of Section 482. It's a problem both ways, is it not?
Your Honor, I don't think it's a problem, and I think the way Treasury implemented the commensurate with income section and in the dash 4F regulations, it reflects exactly what Congress had in mind and the way Treasury understood it, as it has said time after time, including in this rulemaking, that the commensurate with income standard is consistent with the arm's length standard. You begin with an arm's length analysis to figure out what the income is going to be and what costs are allocated, and if the profits are outstripping the payments and the whatever form the cost sharing takes, whatever form the transfer takes, then it can be adjusted by periodic adjustments, which is exactly what the legislative history says. But the legislative history also says that for cost sharing, that you're looking at actual economic activity, which is an analysis of the inputs, not the outputs. And it also says in the House report that explains how this actually works, it talks about all the facts and circumstances on page 426 of report 99-426, which is the arm's length analysis. You look at all the facts and circumstances.
But isn't the government's position that arm's length and comparability are not one and the same?
Well, what the government's position is basically that the arm's length standard has nothing to do with arm's length evidence in this narrow area, which I think is completely unsupported.
No, what they're saying is that we've defined this by regulation to be an arm's length analysis, and that we're not using comparability, but we've defined it to be arm's length. Why aren't they allowed to do that?
They're not allowed to do it because this isn't through the looking glass. They don't get to say a word means whatever they say they want it to mean, because there is they know, and the tax court knew and the Supreme Court knew, that the whole power that is given under Section 482 is not limitless. It is only a power to bring related parties into parity with unrelated parties. And since the beginning, that has been recognized to reflect an arm's length analysis, which is to say, not necessarily a perfect transaction, but you look at what third parties do, you shape whatever the allocation is based on what third parties do. And even the legislative history of Section 42 says that.
In your view, what do you do if there are no similar transactions by unrelated parties?
There are absolutely no similar transaction in any respect.
Right. What is your view of how that has to be done?
Well, you'd have to have some kind of economic analysis using, you know, rigorous economic principles.
Let me just follow that up.
Sure.
And I know you don't agree with this, but if it is a transfer or license of intangible property, Congress has told us what to do. Told the Treasury Department what to do, hasn't it?
It's told the Treasury Department to make periodic adjustments if the income is not in accord with the way the deal was cut. If the too little money is flowing from one side to the other in accord with the benefits. It does not say throw out the arm's length analysis and just sort of start from scratch and have a purely internal analysis. And certainly Treasury said nothing of the sort in the rulemaking. What Treasury said was that, yes, we're invoking commensurate with income. It's consistent with the arm's length standard, as we have said, for lo these many years. And then when challenged on the point, instead of saying, oh, we don't have to worry about comparables, we don't have to worry about evidence, they said, no, we don't like your evidence, so we're going to make up a hypothetical of our own. But that's not discarding evidence of comparable transactions. And I think the important foundational point here is that the tax court found that the evidence of third-party conduct here was probative and included comparable transactions. And the Treasury did not challenge that here. They have not challenged the tax court's finding on its grounds. They have instead said that we have the power to redefine the arm's length standard at will, which is another thing that the 15 tax experts in the tax court couldn't find in any of the notices or preamble, that they could redefine the arm's length standard so that it didn't include arm's length evidence. None of that is there.
What if their notices and preambles expressly said that? What if they said, we're giving you notice, we're going to pass a regulation, and we're going to completely redefine what arm's length means and the way we get there? In other words, we're going to discard comparability analysis. We are going to say that we believe that commensurate with income is consistent with the arm's length standard. If it was very clear on its face from the beginning, would they have the authority to do that?
Well, I think ultimately they do not have the authority to throw parity analysis out the window. The Supreme Court said that parity is the purpose of Section 482, and the addition of commensurate with income, there's no indication that it's meant to override that. In fact, it is meant to enforce parity because in the context of high profit intangibles, which again is the only rationale given, high profit intangibles where stock-based compensation is significant. The only rationale they give is for this narrow piece of the rule. But Section 42 was not, none of it says let's throw out all evidence of what parties do. It says we look at commensurate with income, which like everything else is determined using third-party evidence. So I think at a certain point, if they said we're throwing out all evidence in all stages of the commensurate with income analysis, we're just going to make it up ex cathedra as if we had the power to engage in the sort of formulary apportionment that Professor Aviona favors, you don't see it here. That's why they're grasping at straws, because they realize that's what they're asking for. They're grasping at 1962 committee reports for unenacted legislation has the word formula in it. So that's where they say they have the power. But it's not there. It's not there. I don't think that it would survive. I think they could do a lot of things. I mean, I think they do have some flexibility. But I don't think they could throw out all evidence of third-party conduct when the ultimate goal is to get them to parity, get related parties to parity with unrelated parties. And the second sentence solves a very narrow problem. It doesn't throw out the analysis. So I don't think that would be a violation of Chevron for all the reasons that we said. It's completely unreasonable to do that.
So is the statute, are you saying that the regulations are an unreasonable interpretation of the statute, or that they're not entitled to our deference because they're engaging in an unreasonable interpretation of the regulations?
Well, they're not entitled to our deference because they haven't claimed it. And if you're putting regulation up against regulation, ipsa dixit doesn't solve the problem in Xilinx. So I don't think that's going to get them our deference or get them anywhere. No, we think it's an unreasonable application of the statute for the reasons that we explain at length. The statute includes a parity analysis, and you know, more to the point, or as to the point, this whole notion that you can discard all evidence of third parties' conduct, take the arm's length straight out of the arm's length standard that they recognize as part of the statute, that's nowhere.
I have a sort of a separate question that, if I may, Judge, yeah. I'm sorry. Just you've been arguing alternatively, or two things. One has to do with the terms of the regulation and whether it's reasonable, but the other has to do with evidence in the record. I thought that the inquiry that we're here to make is the validity of the regulation and not the specific evidence in this case, whether it does or does not satisfy the regulation. But in the first instance, we're looking at the validity of the regulation. And as to that, why would the specific evidence in this case make any difference one way or another?
Well, I don't think the evidence in this case makes any difference, Your Honor. I think the rulemaking record makes all the difference.
I'm sorry if I was confusing. I apologize. Thank you for the clarification.
No, the evidence in this case this is just a case, and in our view, they could apply this regulation, apply the arm's length standard, and there may be specific things in this case, and indeed there are other issues in this case that affect pieces of the outcome. But what they can't do is ignore the rulemaking record and not meaningfully respond to it, which is...
What is your response to the government's argument that the rulemaking record may very well show that these kinds of stock-based compensations is not considered an economic cost, but it is an accounting cost, and so why can't it be considered? And they just rejected what they thought to be irrelevant evidence.
Well, the fact that the regulation on its face disavows reliance on financial accounting standards, I think, ought to take care of that argument, as the tax court found. And they did not engage with the economic cost argument. That was another thing that the tax court noted, that there were fairly significant analyses why stock-based compensation is not the kind of cost that is shared by unrelated parties. And if 482 gives them the power only to allocate, to bring related parties into parity, you can't allocate to make people do something unrelated parties can't do. Yes, they can go commensurate with income. That's a very special, specialized piece of the analysis
it's
that
more
under
than
their rate
can,
comes to the end.
Counsel, it's more than can. They must, according to the statute.
Absolutely, Your Honor. We don't dispute that if that applied, they would have to apply it here. But that does not allow them to completely throw out arm's length evidence as to the rest of the analysis. Their own regulations begin in the 4F regulations begin with an arm's length analysis. Then they figure out whether there needs to be any retroactive adjustment based on profit. It doesn't just start. It doesn't start in the ether the way they're asking to do here. And the whole point of the Section 482 adjustment is, again, it's let the chips fall where they may. That's what First Security says. The commissioner comes in and says, well, I know that arm's length parties couldn't actually pay this, but we're going to require it to be transferred in the non-arm's length context because we think they can do it and they have different incentives. And the Supreme Court says, forget about it. You can't do that. It doesn't matter what the result is. It matters. Your power here is to bring parties into parity, not to do whatever might produce the most revenue. And that's the same thing here. No unrelated parties share stock-based compensation. They can reach their analysis. And again, we don't think it applies to cost sharing. We don't think commensurate with income applies to cost sharing. But if it did, they could draw their analysis based on the usual arm's length factors. You take it as far as you can go, and then you adjust for the differences in the particular transaction, which is what the courts and the IRS have been doing for years. I mean, that's what all their analyses, their alternate methods under commensurate with income look to various types of third party conduct and they figure out what the price ought to have been. And that's how it works. It doesn't start from a vacuum the way they're claiming they can do now. And they're claiming, you know, to be able to get away completely from any kind of empirical analysis, and yet they're still claiming that the regulation and that commensurate with income is consistent with the arm's length standard. And as the tax court, which knows a thing or two about the arm's length standard, having first articulated it in 1933, its predecessor, said that's necessarily an empirical determination whether it's consistent with the arm's length standard. They may have some leeway, as of course they do, when it comes to what the numbers are in a particular case, but it's an empirical determination.
What's your response to the government's argument is, even if it is an empirical determination and even if the tax court does have expertise in that area, it doesn't have expertise in Chevron?
It does not have any particular expertise in Chevron, no, but it does have expertise in the meaning of the arm's length standard. It does have expertise in what reasonable experts could discern from the rulemaking record, and none of those 15 tax experts could see this argument that they're raising now, that they can brush aside the arm's length standard, the arm's length evidence in the arm's length standard. That's the piece that's new. They're coming back to saying they're applying the arm's length standard, but they're still getting rid of all the evidence, and no one could see that. Neither the commenters nor the 15 tax court judges could find their new position that evidence is irrelevant or extraneous. And indeed, that's not what they said. If there were any doubt, even if there were some ambiguity, even if, you know, there were some crumbs in the notice, and I don't think there are, that take this strong a position, the preamble should have removed all doubt. It talks about the arm's length standard 30 times, goes piece by piece of the evidence. It's conclusory, but it goes piece by piece of the evidence of similar transactions. And then it makes up a transaction of its own, saying this is what arm's length parties generally would do. And the tax court said you can't say what parties generally would do when all the evidence is to the contrary. You have to try something else if you want to get there. And they haven't challenged that. I think is one of the keys here, because they are taking a position here that is so at odds with what they've said before. We're not disputing that when commensurate with income applies, they get to look at the income in the particular transaction and adjust the proportions. What we are saying is you can't start by defining income in a way that has nothing to do with the arm's length standard and the way related parties define income, and put things into income and put things into costs that unrelated parties would not do. They didn't claim that right in the preamble, and they don't have that right. I think it's also telling that at oral argument now they've peeled things back a little bit, but they get further and further out in their claims of power, from being able to modify the arm's length standard to saying it's in the statute, but commensurate with income overrides it. And the supplemental brief said it never had any content, so it doesn't matter what we do. And all of this gets back to the most fundamental points here, which are that it's very important to keep agency rulemaking transparent. So regulated parties don't have to guess at the reasoning of agencies, particularly when agencies are seeking to expand their power, as the Treasury and IRS are seeking to do here, and take the 482 adjustment power beyond the parity purpose that is recognized to be the purpose of the statute, and is something the IRS can't change through regulation or any other way. And that's the reasons are so that the regulated parties can comment intelligently, can respond, can understand without guessing at the agency's reasoning, that they can respond intelligently, that the agencies can take the input and have their reasoning as well as the mere text of the proposed regulation challenged, because the supporting reasoning is critical here, because it suggests further powers to do further things, as would any preamble when you are supporting a regulation, and also to let the political process work if the agency stakes out an extreme position, as it does here in essentially taking the arm's length standard. That's not empty proceduralism. It's a critical tool to limiting executive action in a democracy. And that's why the tax court made an unusual, unanimous 15-0 statement to the IRS that you have to follow the APA just like everybody else does. And you have to follow it the same way everybody else does. And it's especially important for this court to set down the same rules, because this court's precedent governs all the agencies, not just the Treasury, not just the IRS, but EPA, DHS, NLRB. Obviously, this court sees them all. And these rules apply to everybody. So these principles have to be honored for the IRS just like they have to be honored for everybody else. They have to say what they're doing and let people respond in a meaningful way and not come back at the end with something and say it was hidden under the dust there. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Your rebuttal.
One thing that struck me when I went back and listened to the first argument is that Mr. Falk twice used the phrase contradiction in terms to describe the notion that some related party transactions must satisfy a purely internal standard in order to achieve an arm's length result. So let me make 4 points in response to that. First, the statutory commensurate with income requirement is, by its terms, a purely internal standard. It requires a comparison of the two sides of the related party transaction, not a comparison of the related party transaction to transactions between unrelated parties. There's simply no getting around that. Second, the commensurate with income requirement is just that, a requirement, as Judge Graber was noting. Shall be commensurate. One related party's benefit shall be commensurate with the other related party's benefit. The third point is that the commensurate with income requirement does not require Treasury to allow taxpayers to override its terms by resort to evidence of third-party behavior. And again, you can compare that approach with the approach of the proposed overhaul of Section 482 in 1962, when Congress did provide such an escape hatch. The fourth point is that we know that 2 years after it enacted the commensurate with income requirement, Congress legislatively confirmed that requirement is consistent with U.S. tax treaties, almost all of which incorporate the arm's length standard.
So let me ask you something I forgot to ask you in your first session, and that is, one of the arguments that you and your amici make is that this is really important because this stock-based compensation has become a real thing in recent times, and so there is a tax avoidance that is allowed through that mechanism if we don't adjust these costs this way. And I guess my problem with that is that, you know, not that avoiding taxes, as long as it's legal, is not in and of itself per se bad under the law. But if it's true that this is a whole new thing and that the world is changing, how could we say that that was the backdrop against which Congress was legislating back in 1986?
Well, I don't think Congress was legislating against the backdrop of stock-based compensation. That's not part of the legislative history. What they were legislating, or the backdrop that they were legislating against, was that comparability analysis was not working in the context of transfers or licenses of intangible property. So, and if I can just get back to the point about the contradiction in terms, what Altera refers to as a contradiction in terms is simply the juxtaposition of the commensurate with income requirement and the arm's length standard. And clearly, Altera views that as a contradiction in terms, because its understanding of the arm's length standard as always requiring resort to evidence of third-party behavior cannot be reconciled with the commensurate with income requirement. And getting back to the APA argument, Altera does not really contend that Treasury failed to explain that it was implementing legislative intent as revealed in the 1986 conference report. Their real complaint seems to be that Treasury did not adequately explain the rationale behind the legislative intent. And in other words, they seem to argue that Treasury did not adequately explain how Congress arrived at the conclusion that the purely internal standard of the commensurate with income requirement is consistent with the arm's length standard. And the short answer to that argument is that any perceived shortcoming in Treasury's explanation of Congress's rationale for the directive that Treasury was plainly implementing simply cannot form the basis for an APA violation.
Thank you, counsel. The case just argued to be submitted for decision. I thank all of you for traveling out here for the arguments, and we'll be in recess for the afternoon.